Good morning. We're here this morning to hear the case of Damian Reyes versus the Secretary of Veterans Affairs. But before we do, we have a pleasant task. Mr. Sklar?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Cary Sklar, counsel to the clerk of the court. And this morning it is my pleasure to move the admission to the bar of this court of Mr. Christopher G. Carlson. Mr. Carlson is a member of the bars of Minnesota and Virginia, and I am satisfied that Mr. Carlson meets the requirements for admission to our bar, and so therefore I move his admission.
Okay. Mr. Carlson, you prepared to be admitted to the bar?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. If you'd raise your right hand, absent the clerk here, I'll administer the oath to you. Do you solemnly swear to conduct yourself as an attorney and counselor of this court uprightly and according to the law, and that you will support the Constitution of the United States?
Yes, I will.
Well, welcome to bar, Mr. Carlson. It appears that you have a practice in representing veterans and individuals in the armed forces who seek relief within the armed forces system. We welcome you here, and we look forward to seeing you at oral argument from time to time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Welcome.
Okay, we're now prepared to hear the case of Damian Reyes versus the Secretary, docket number 031929. Who will speak for Mr. Reyes?
Your Honor, my name is Richard James. I'm here on behalf of Mr. Reyes.
Okay, and who will speak for the Secretary?
Your Honor, my name is Brent Boker on behalf of the Secretary, and I'm joined by Richard Mayer at the Council's table.
Okay, thank you very much. Mr. James?
May I reserve 15 minutes, please?
You may. Make it so, please.
Thank you, sir. First of all, the Secretary got two things right in the Secretary's brief, which we wish to admit to. The first is that we overstated Mr. Reyes's position in the opening brief. The version that we wish to stick with is in our reply brief in the middle paragraph on page 11. Our contention is not that the VA never grants a waiver. Our position is that by defining bad faith in the way that it did, the VA has given itself the authority to do so if it wishes. The second thing that we wish to admit is that the VA may be correct. This appeal may ultimately turn on factual issues as to whether or not the evidence satisfies the test for bad faith. And that remark gives me a springboard to turn to a summary of our positions as to the two debts. The first debt, as you may recall, is nicely described by the BVA in its opinion at pages 4 and 5 as consisting of three discrete parts. In the first part, there was an unreported increase in Social Security benefits. In the second part, there was an unreported benefit from the Maritime Union. And in the last part, there was anticipated income of the wife in 1996. The point we would like to make as to each one of these at the evidentiary level is that there is apparently no evidence in the claims file from any source to justify any of those three debts other than from Mr. Reyes himself in the various things that he sent to the VA in response, one assumes, to its inquiries. And so he asks rhetorically, look, I told you about these things myself. How can that be bad faith? In other words, he may have been late reporting these events, but he did indeed disclose them himself. As to the large debt, which is the second and newest of the two debts, in our brief we asked where the evidence might be of the income matching report on which the VA appeared to rely at that time. Examining the claim file and the record in preparation for this argument, I noticed that the VA also purported to rely on reports, one of which was not attributed, and the other of which was attributed to Mr. Reyes's then ex-wife. And a third piece of paper says, we have verified that. And so when one looks to the record on appeal or the claim file, one goes looking for the income matching report, which I assume is some kind of computer product, and one goes looking for some kind of a letter from Mrs. Reyes to the VA saying, I had income in those 2 years, but those documents are not in there. From this point, as to the large second newer debt,
Counselor, let me interrupt for a minute.
Please.
Those documents you indicated are not in the record. Are there tax returns in the record for the years 96 forward?
No, Your Honor.
And do you happen to know whether or not Mr. and Mrs. Reyes filed a joint tax income tax return, 96, 97, 98, 99?
I do not know. If I were to suppose, my supposition would be yes.
Okay. Well, that leads me to the ultimate question, I guess, which is, if in fact, even though they had some domestic turmoil in their lives, which is a large part of Mr. Reyes's justification, I guess, or extenuation mitigation, and they filed jointly, married filing jointly, then he would have been aware of her income by his signature on the income tax return.
But the evidence isn't there.
Say again.
But the evidence isn't there. And that leads me to the point I was headed for. One of the signal duties of the Board of Veterans' Appeals is to evaluate the evidence. Well, with no evidence in the record to evaluate, the board obviously did not satisfy its mission.
Let me try to understand your argument, make sure I understand the argument you're making. Is your argument that the that the board made a finding that Mr. Reyes, in these two instances, received pension income and did so in order to get that income, acted in bad faith, and the board made that finding. Is that correct? I mean, is that a correct statement of the a sort of fact one?
That's the board's position.
That's the board's position, not yours. I understand that. Now, if we were to grant relief to Mr. Reyes, we would have to find that that finding was improper, correct?
Yes.
And what standard would you have the court use?
Well, you certainly leaped right into the snarl in this case. Ostensibly, and according to your precedent, the standard for a finding of bad faith on review here would be clearly erroneous. However, it's not quite that simple.
Okay, now let me stop you before you go further. I'll allow you to do that.
Yes, sir.
But where in your brief do you make the argument that you're about to make now?
I don't recall that we did.
Okay, then my next question is, why should we consider it now?
Well, of course, we've done a better job preparing now than we did the first time. But the board stated the standard as preponderance when it considered bad faith, and it got the standard wrong. The VA raised the factual review standard in its own brief, and so I think that puts it in play. However, I'm willing to go further than that if I will be heard.
Okay. By all means. But understand, that's a problem for me.
I do understand.
Okay.
But let's dive into it. One of the things that you have to ask rhetorically about this kind of case is, why does it matter that bad faith is in issue? And the answer seems to me to be that the other two bars to waiver, which are not an issue yet, fraud and misrepresentation, carry with them, at least in the common law view, higher standards for proof of intent. There was a famous bankruptcy case in which the Supreme Court said, in short, that the Congress relieved the federal government of the higher standards for proof of intent in bankruptcy cases. And what the case establishes for Mr. Reyes is that there is out there a different standard prevailing under the common law and in many of the states. And the standard for intent, under their view, is clear and convincing. Now, that's as to only one or two of the elements involved in these cases. And so it appears to me that there is some umbrella standard, which is clearly erroneous, as to the ultimate question, is there fraud? So why are we talking about fraud? Well, because it has that more rigorous standard. So now we turn to misrepresentation, which is an element in fraud and in the common law and states, we think. Misrepresentation also requires clear and convincing evidence of the intent. So there is something in Mr. Reyes's view about intent as one discrete or two discrete elements that requires special evidence other than preponderance and reviewable for other than clearly erroneous. And so the presence in the statute and in the VA regulations of a badly defined bar to the waiver gives the VA a way around the two more rigorous bars. You might ask, well, what is this common law conversation about when you talk about fraud as one of the pickets on the fence? The VA adopted the common law as to fraud in its adjudication manual, M21-1, paragraph 36.01. So that's why this case is important, Judge Hagel, and that's why it is important to go further than the brief. Now, we return to the brief at this point, and we embrace the argument that we made about the definition provided by the VA in its regulation. I went looking for some explanation for how those words hit ink, and I didn't find it. It's not in the final rule, which was published in 1993 for the first time, and it's not in the proposal for the final rule, which was published in 1993 also for the first time. So there is also nothing in the statute, of which Mr. Reyes is aware at least, or any other statute of which Mr. Reyes is aware, that defines bad faith. And so we're left completely adrift in searching for what is the authority or the dignity of the words that the VA chose. And, of course, having gotten that far, then Mr. Reyes says, look, half of those words never contributed anything. And yet, if you take those words out, you're left still with something which purports to be a VA definition of bad faith, but even the definition neatened up, made tight, even that definition does not provide the adjudicating personnel with any way in which to discriminate case A from case B. And that's Mr. Reyes's chief complaint in this appeal.
Well, what about the elements that the conduct must be unfair or deceptive?
Well, as a lawyer, I'm embarrassed, but one must ask, what does this word unfair mean? And what does this word deceptive mean? And how many intents are involved in the conversation? The board apparently parsed out at least two intents. One intent to deceive, and then a second intent during the deception to prevail, gain some unfair advantage at the expense of the VA. And we return now to the introductory part of my argument, which asks, well, what's the standard for those findings of intent at the board, and is the standard to which the board apparently adhered, preponderance, is that enough? So yes, you're right, it's inescapable that deception and benefit are some kinds of concerns to the adjudicator applying that definition, but the definition doesn't tell anybody, including Mr. Reyes, how to discriminate his case from the next case. Seeing that there appear to be no...
Let me back you up just 1 second, counsel.
Please.
With regard to the VA's definition provided in its regulation of the term bad faith, if a definition is what it is, is that a definition that would be permissible under the statute? And is the problem that you're articulating the fact that VA has not provided a rationale for the adoption of that particular set of words? Or is there some other argument here?
There's a combination. We have no complaint that the VA didn't supply its rationale. We were not a participant in the rulemaking, and we defer to the VA's decisions on how it wants to make rules. But our pitch in the opening brief, and we stick to it now, is that the statute is undermined because the VA defined one of the statutory terms in such a way as to swing the gate open at any time it wants. So the regulation is, in our view, not consistent with the statute and therefore not reasonable.
In the statute itself, what import do you attach to the words indication of?
the far list question. Indication or indicia, I think indicia pops up somewhere else, maybe in the reg, indication of.
Doesn't that indicate a fairly low threshold in Congress's view?
Well, that's what this court wrote in Farless, in the second half of the Farless decision. The second half of the decision, though, is obvious dicta. It's virtually an advisory opinion to the VA, saying, dear VA, you missed this. And the VA has done nothing to tell us in the regulation what an indication is. And I'm deeply concerned on behalf of Mr. Reyes and other people in his vote that having a mere indication as being the trigger point for a statutory opportunity is inconsistent with everything else about veterans' benefits law. It seems to transfer the burden of proof to Mr. Reyes to show himself to be innocent of all things. It seems to withdraw from him the benefit of any doubt. It seems to go beyond the clear and convincing discussion that I had with you about these bars. And it makes something even lower than a preponderance available to the VA for the denial of waiver. Because, of course, if an indication is something less than a finding, then in that instance, just a finding as to one element might be enough. The deception, the advantage. But I have to remind you that that's not the way the board analyzed this case. And were you to go that way in deciding it in your conference, you would risk some chenery deficiency because the board didn't go that way. When the board decided this case, it made a finding about bad faith. It's absolutely true that it made other findings about elements of bad faith, but its conclusion lumps all of the debts, all four of them, into one basket and says preponderance, bad faith.
Counsel, you're losing me on four. My count is that Mr. Reyes was allegedly overpaid on six different occasions. So he was familiar with the drill, the process, if you will.
Mr. Reyes has a sixth-grade education. It's not shown in the record that he speaks English. He's from Puerto Rico. And when these events were transpiring, he was already in his 70s at the very least, and he was probably already in bad health as a result of more than a few serious medical conditions. So we have to be careful when we draw inferences from the evidence that we've got in this record on appeal about the state of his mind and the extent of his capacities.
I was alluding, I guess, to my colleague's comment about, or your comment about indicia. And one would see a different factual pattern, if you will, if this were the first time that Mr. Reyes had come across this overpayment question and reporting requirement. However, I think that when you are dealing with an individual who has gone through this process on four or five or six separate occasions prior to that, one would believe that he had some familiarity with the system or the requirements. And that's merely a comment on my part relative to this question of indicia of mens rea.
I have to try to push you back from that and ask you to examine the inference that you're drawing. Look at the forms in the record on appeal, for example, and you see Mr. Reyes's untutored signature on forms that are clearly filled out by some other hand or by some kind of a program on the VA's form, sometimes typed into the form, so that the extent to which Mr. Reyes is a personal participant in making the statements on the forms is not so reliable as it would be if you were looking at my income tax return. And the considerations as to health, age, education, background, and things like that pull that inference a little bit further apart. And a little bit is all we want. Our position is that the record does not support findings as to his motivation or findings as to his intention to deceive.
I note your time is up. Judge Mormer or Judge Lance, do you have any other questions that you want to ask during this?
Not at this time.
Okay.
Thank you.
May it please the court, again, I am Brent Boker, representing the Secretary of Veterans Affairs.
Okay, and how do you spell your last name?
It's B-O-W-K-E-R.
Okay, Mr. Boker, thank you.
And today we are here to discuss the validity of the Secretary's regulation defining the words bad faith. The Secretary does agree with the appellant that the statute does not define bad faith. And so all we have to look to is the Secretary's regulation on that part. In his presentation today, he stated that the regulation gives the Secretary so much, I guess the word would be leeway, to decide what is bad faith, that it's basically invalid because it would conflict with the statute otherwise. The Secretary's position is that is not what the regulation does. The way Secretary reads the regulation, there are three requirements for bad faith. There is an intent to seek an unfair advantage, a knowledge of the likely consequences on the part of the person who is requesting the waiver, and a resulting loss to the government. It's not the Secretary's position is that that does not give the Secretary so much room to decide that it's unreviewable by the court. The board makes findings on this, and then a person can take it up to the court for review. And consequently, the regulation does not conflict with the statute in any way. It just defines a way for the Secretary to decide what is bad faith. And that's exactly what Congress intended when they wrote the statute, because it says, in the Secretary's opinion, there exists, among other things, bad faith on the part of the appellant. And if you look to appellant's opening brief, he cites a case, Aerolíneas Argentinas, for the standard of review for regulations. And in that case, the Federal Circuit says the court gives appropriate deference to an agency's interpretation of an ambiguous statute that it is charged with administering. And the Secretary would assert that because there's no definition of bad faith in the statute, that appropriate deference would be given to our regulation in this case.
Counselor, let me pursue a couple of lines that I did with Mr. James. First and foremost, I guess, is this issue of a joint income tax return that I asked Mr. James about. He said it's not part of the record. Wouldn't that have been one of the first things that someone would have done when an individual says, my wife was making income that I didn't know about because we were having domestic turmoil? And does the Secretary have the authority to say, could you please produce your 1997 income tax returns? And then made that part of the record, assuming that it was married filing jointly, declaring that income that Mr. Reyes says that he didn't know about, and if it were a joint return, both of them would have signed it. Isn't that a fair assessment of the evidentiary progress of this case or the way it could have been handled?
I believe the Secretary would have the authority to ask for that, but I don't know of any requirement that says the Secretary is required to ask for that and that the record would be underdeveloped if the Secretary didn't.
Well, but if you have a veteran saying, gee, I didn't know my estranged wife was making income.
Yes.
And I'm asking for equity from the Secretary in terms of relief from this repayment. Isn't there some type of obligation on the part of the Secretary to pursue this a little bit to ascertain the legitimacy, if you will, of Mr. Reyes's initial claim?
I'm unaware of any obligation in the statute or the regulations on waiver requests that requires the Secretary to seek any extra, to advise a person seeking a waiver to provide any extra documents that they haven't already provided. I'm not saying that it's prohibited, that the Secretary couldn't on his own free will do that, but I'm unaware of any regulation or statute that requires the Secretary to do that.
Well, that's kind of why we're here today, isn't it? I mean, the claim of Mr. Reyes and his counsel is that we have this amorphous standard out there floating around and nobody seems to know what the rules are.
Right.
And basically what you're doing in your response is confirming that nobody seems to know how it is that the Secretary comes to these conclusions, and that's why we're here at oral argument today, isn't it?
The Secretary does say that people can request a waiver and send documentation in with their waiver request. But if the veteran doesn't send any documentation, I don't know that there's anything that requires the Secretary to say, well, you're not going to be granted a waiver on what you sent me. Maybe this would be a better way to go about it, send in the tax returns or send in X, Y, or Z. I don't believe that there's any, Congress didn't attach any duty to assist or anything to this type of request by an applicant for a waiver.
Well, let me talk a little bit about the son's income. The son had income that was countered against Mr. Reyes's income, I guess.
That's correct.
And then the issue becomes whether or not Mr. Reyes has the right to declare the son for income tax purposes as a deduction, or for our purposes here. And isn't it logical to assume that if I'm required to include my son's income in my gross income, that I should be entitled to declare him as a dependent?
I'm not sure that it follows, because the IRS may allow you to declare someone as a dependent when they're above the age that VA may not allow you to declare someone as a dependent.
Well, but it's again, I guess, testing this mens rea or bad faith, if you will, that okay, I'm required to include my son's income, so logically it would follow, under my frame of reference, that I should be able to declare him or her as a dependent to offset some of that income. And so I guess I'm just trying to get at this issue of bad faith and to ascertain, at least in my own mind, whether or not it would be an act of bad faith to follow that line of logic. And that troubles me some.
In this case, the veteran was informed several times that he had to report his income, and he did so on many occasions, and he even had their statements in the record. I believe there's one on page 131 where he says, I understand I have to report all the sources of income that I have. And it was the inference the board drew from his he was told several times, and then he demonstrated his knowledge by reporting the income, mm-hmm. and then by reporting it incorrectly, the board said that draws an inference of an intent to seek bad faith. I think that goes more not to whether the content of the regulation, but to the board's fact-finding in this case. And I don't believe that appellant has demonstrated that that's not a permissible view of the evidence in this record.
Well, the difference is whether or not it's a misunderstanding or a bad faith effort.
Correct.
Right?
Yes.
And that's, I think, the issue that we're all kind of grappling with here as to whether or not there was truly bad faith. And even if there is not bad faith, the Secretary has the ability to say, I am not going to grant the waiver, given the equitable power that Congress has given me. Isn't that true?
That's correct. But I would step back a second and kind of rephrase what you said. I don't know that the issue...
Excuse me, Mr. Boker.
Yes.
May I make a suggestion to you?
Yes.
When you address the court, please do so by saying Your Honor or Judge to a question.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Sorry, Your Honor. I don't think the issue is exactly whether or not there is bad faith. The issue is whether, based on this record, the board's finding that there is bad faith is plausible based on this record. Someone could look at it and say there might be multiple findings that are plausible. Someone could find, based on this record, that it was inadvertent, or someone could find, based on this record, that it was bad faith. It's not whether you could find the other one also, but whether what the board found was plausible.
Well, so it's your position, I take it from what you say, that's the Secretary's position, that the finding of bad faith in this situation is a finding of fact. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. And therefore,
we should review this under a clearly erroneous standard, that finding. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor, for the findings that the board made. And that goes back to the Farless case where the court stated that was a finding of fact. And I believe that it's continued to the Luenas case that was cited in both briefs, where the court again said that the finding of whether there is bad faith is a finding of fact. Moving on, although appellant didn't address this argument in his oral argument today, the Secretary would like to address what he terms the mitigating measures. These are regulations 1.900 to 1.954 that he said the board should have considered when it decided whether to grant his waiver but did not. Is the Secretary's position that these regulations apply only to collection of debts and not to considerations of validity of debt and whether or not to grant a waiver? In this case, if you look to the board's, to the Committee on Waivers jurisdiction, for example, 1.956, it doesn't give it jurisdiction to consider any of those elements except for compromise. And with respect to compromise, the Reg 1.958 states that there's no appeal from a decision on compromise from the Committee on Waivers. So with respect to those regulations, the Secretary respectfully asserts that although Gordon did remand those to the board for them to decide in the first instance, the Secretary's position is the court should affirm this case because those regulations weren't pertinent to the discussion in this case because the board was only considering the validity of a debt and whether a waiver is appropriate. Also, moving on from that, in appellant's brief, he asked this court to reconsider whether VCAA applies to creation of applications for waiver, and the Secretary asserts that the court should not reconsider that, but instead follow what was found in Barger and Lueris and determine that VCAA does not apply to the waiver. And lastly, with respect to the claims referred to the board in its 1998 decision to the RO for adjudication, the service connection claims, the Secretary's position is those are not inextricably intertwined with the consideration of a waiver. If Mr. Reyes was to be granted service connection, that would be his money. It may be offset by any overpayment that he owes to the government. But if a waiver was granted, he would get the money entirely.
Counsel, let me return you to the legal issue that's the crux of what we're discussing here, as described by the appellant in his reply brief, is that the definition that VA provided for bad faith confers unfettered discretion on the VA to deny as many waivers as it wishes, thereby thwarting the legislative intent of that provision.
That's correct. You
would, walk me through the three criteria that you have laid out and tell me why those three criteria preclude sweeping somebody in who is operating in good faith.
Okay, Your Honor. The first one would be the conduct, although not undertaken with actual fraudulent intent, is undertaken with intent to seek an unfair advantage. And that's the first one. Number two would be with knowledge of the likely consequences. And number three would be results in a loss to the government.
Now, the assertion is that that's so broad that it potentially allows the board to apply this bar to anybody who comes to the board with unfettered discretion. Explain to me how those three criteria fetter that discretion, if you would, please.
Okay. I'll just give a hypothetical to show it's easier to me for to work with some facts, Your Honor, that aren't this case. This applies to all indebtedness to the VA. So, for example, if VA guaranteed a home loan and someone lost their job and was unable and their house was foreclosed on and VA had to pay that because of the guarantee, they apply for a waiver and the VA would look at the intent. Is there an intent to seek an unfair advantage from the government when the job market changes and you've lost your job? I honestly don't see how it gives VA any unfair advantage, any unfettered discretion, because there is a finding to be made of intent on the part of the person who is seeking a waiver. And also a finding of the knowledge of their actions, what would happen if what they did to seek rise to the debt would have consequences. In this case, Your Honor, the finding was Mr. Reyes had knowledge of the consequences because he was informed and he demonstrated his knowledge by reporting income. If, for example, if Mr. Reyes had sent letters back saying, I don't understand these reporting requirements when he was reporting his income to the VA, it could demonstrate that he didn't have knowledge. On the facts of this case, the board made a finding that the requirements of 1.965B2 were met. But I don't think appellant has demonstrated that it gives so much discretion to the agency that they would just be able to say, well, these are met in every single case when there are many, many factual situations that can give rise to a debt owed to VA.
Let me ask a question, I think, slightly differently, and that is, in a case such as this, let's say Mr. Reyes's case, what information could he have presented to the VA, or what information could have been in the record upon which the committee could have properly based a finding that he did not act in bad faith? I'm not sure I asked that well.
I understand, I think, the question, Your Honor. I suppose he could have submitted testimony from people that knew him at the time, demonstrating his complete, not only unawareness that his wife was working, but conviction that she was, in fact, not working at the time, even though that she was living at his home. You know, if he had a friend who said, you know, Mr. Reyes always says his wife is not working during that time period, I suppose that would be evidence that there was no intent. He was intending to accurately report his income, but he was unable to do so because of something his wife was doing that was misleading to him. I'm sure there could be other evidence that he could have presented that. There is a possibility for him to have a hearing in this case as well, which he could have presented testimony and further fleshed out his position, but he chose not to request a hearing. That probably would have been helpful, but it's not required that people request a hearing.
Well, Counselor, if you would, Judge Hagel, were you done with that line?
Yeah, go ahead.
You have the bad faith bar. It says we're not even going to consider other evidence or evidence in mitigation, extenuation, et cetera, et cetera. However, the Secretary or the committee can conclude that there is not bad faith. But based upon the evidence that you presented to me, buddy, I'm not going to give you the relief that you seek. Isn't that available?
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct.
So you make it over the bar, the bad faith bar, saying, well, it's a misunderstanding. And then you look at the merits of the case and say, but I'm not going to give you the relief, and you still have to pay back the money.
Yes, okay. Your Honor, but The board and the Committee on Waivers never reached that determination in this case because they found that that is barred.
That's my point.
Oh.
And so when you're barring someone and not giving everyone the opportunity to explain their position and so forth, that's a fairly extreme remedy, if you will.
Yes, Your Honor, but it's not the Secretary who has barred these people. It's Congress when they created the statute.
Understood. But it's the responsibility of the Secretary to enact the congressional intent in a fair and even-handed manner.
Yeah, I agree, Your Honor. Yes.
Okay. All right.
If there are no further questions, the Secretary requests that the Court affirm the Board's decision. Thank you.
Any questions?
Judge Lance, earlier you asked about the other debts, and somehow we got off that question and wandered someplace else. The other debts were paid, as best I can tell from the record. One of them was quite significant. It was $4,000 and some dollars, $4,800, I think, at the beginning. And Mr. Reyes sent in four money orders, says the record, to pay $4,300 more or less of that amount. And the fate of the remaining money is not clear in the record. And as I recall now, there was a smaller debt, much smaller, less than $1,000, that was also paid earlier in the case. But the easy solution to this part of the colloquy is that those other debts are not at issue. Continuing, Judge Lance, just because it was convenient, it's fresh in my mind, your last inquiry about the significance of a bar as opposed to the more subjective, may I say that way, analysis that's involved with equity and good conscience in the decision whether or not to grant a waiver if it's permissible, not barred. Interestingly, in this record, as I think you see in a lot of debt cases, the Committee on Waiver and the Regional Office addressed a equity and good conscience factor, namely fault. I think there are six or seven factors listed by the regulation. The fault of the veteran is the first one listed. Of course, it would always be significant in overpayment cases because the inferences are so readily drawn against the veteran that the veteran is somehow conniving. Some of the other factors are fault of the agency. Balancing of the fault, I think, is the way the VA puts it. And then that leads to some other inquiries as to waiver, if not barred. They're not fresh in my mind. The significance of this to me is that even the regional offices misunderstand the inquiry. And because of that, we maintain they are lured into findings as to fraud, misrepresentation, or bad faith too readily. I think that's another one of Mr. Reyes's principal points in this appeal. Turning to other questions that were posed to the VA, one of the ones that is most significant to us this morning as lawyers and judges is what information could Mr. Reyes have produced? And, of course, one's reply to that question is limited only by your imagination. He could have sent in a statement of the very same assertions that he made unsworn, sending the statement in as an affidavit or a declaration with the benefit of an oath. He could, as counsel mentioned, seek the statements of neighbors. He could have sought a statement from the wife as to the large second and newest debt. He could have perhaps gotten his federal income tax returns. As you know, he lives in Florida, which I believe has no state income tax, so he would not have done that. A person in Mr. Reyes's circumstances probably has resort to some other state or federal benefits, and he might have found some documents in their files, in the files of responsible agencies having to do with welfare and medical assistance. Who knows how many things he might have sought had he only known exactly what it was he needed to do. But there are two problems with that. The first problem, and the one that's most significant, is that tends to transfer the burden of proof from the creditor to the debtor, from the VA as paternalistic protector to the veteran. If this system includes that paternalism when it gets to the conversation about debts for overpayment, we maintain that it does, then the transfer of the burden of proof should be the last possible consideration. The other thing that comes up in this appeal because of an inquiry like that is the need of the VA to inform the debtor, claimant, veteran, what it was that he needed to prove. And that brings us to our argument in the briefs that 38 CFR 3.159B gives the agency the responsibilities in this situation that the VCAA gives to it in disability compensation claims. Finally, returning to our principal theme, which you clearly grasp completely, about unfettered discretion, that's the whole point. And the question is, in examining a standard that does that, without any explanatory document about the definition which prescribes the test, either in the regulations or in their history in the Federal Register or in the legislative history. By the way, we looked at the statute. We found nothing in the statute about bad faith or indication. That leads all the way back to our beginning point, which was that, look, there are three bars and they all have something in common. They all require proof of intents, and we know that in two of those instances, proofs of intents generally require that that element, as opposed to the umbrella, be shown by a higher level of evidence than preponderance.
Could the VA establish a lower level? Why are they bound by what the common law definition is, or standard of proof is?
Well, that's a fine question at the academic level, Judge Hagel, but the fact is that they chose to be bound as to fraud. We extend from that, since misrepresentation is a component of fraud, that they're bound by it as to misrepresentation, and they didn't make a choice to do otherwise in this case. What they might be allowed to do if they were to do the rulemaking this afternoon is a fair question, but it doesn't tell you how to dispose of Mr. Reyes's case. I do urge, however, once more at the risk of going beyond the brief, that when you look further about intents, you may find cases in the Federal Circuit, which has patent jurisdiction, about bad faith in patent cases. And indeed, it turns out that the regulations of the Patent and Trademark Office require that the applicant for a patent act in good faith and disclose, I think they call it prior science, prior knowledge. I've just told you three times more than I actually know about patent law, except that if you wander through the Lexis reports, you find Lanham Act cases dealing with bad faith in patenting, and yes, once again, the requirement is for proof of the intent to deceive by clear and convincing evidence. So the theme we urge is that the entire statute deals at three points with intent, and every time it does it, the canopy of law that is over both of us, the Federal Circuit and this court, in patent cases and in these cases and in state cases involving fraud, every single time asks that the adjudicator test findings of intention and motivation by a higher standard than has been met in this case.
Counselor, I think that's a pretty fair summation of what's troubling me about this case. Being from the West, the concept of a bar is, buddy, you're lying to me, and I'm not going to process any more of your paperwork because you are lying to me, which are fighting words in Idaho, which is far different, Secretary's counsel, at least in my opinion, from saying, well, this could have been misunderstanding or it could have been intentional misrepresentation, but we're not gonna lock the doors to the courthouse or the process to you. We'll go through the process and maybe conclude that waiver of your debt is not appropriate because you have had this prior experience and you may have had knowledge and you may have filed a joint income tax return indicating that you had full knowledge of your wife's income. So therefore, we're not going to grant you the relief that you seek. That's all doable, as I understand the system. The real hang-up here, I think, that Mr. James has pointed out is you say, we're going to bar you because we find bad faith, and that stops the process and basically denies your ability to proceed in terms of evaluating the merits and the balance of the case. That's the crux of your argument, if I understand it.
And then we tack on to that the thought that the statement of the standard, the definition for bad faith, is so generous to the adjudicator that it gives a wily adjudicator a way to avoid confronting the difficult issues that one finds in assertions of fraud or misrepresentation. And this is, it's a dixit, observations from other cases, but I think you'll be generous to accept them. This is not uncommon in debt cases, what you're seeing in these cases. This is not the only file in a debt case that I've seen in which there is a reference to income matching evidence, but no evidence in the file. So what's going on out there appears to this observer to be, from a sampling of very few cases, that the adjudicators pick up the telephone and dial a number or tickle a computer with an interagency analysis, and they get some information, but it doesn't go into the file. And so the BVA doesn't see it, therefore does not assess it, simply assumes that that the assertions of the regional office are correct, and that's the end of it. And the door then slams squarely in the face of the applicant for the waiver, because, of course, the VA has assumed away the factual question of whether or not there's reliable evidence, relied on the preponderance standard to find evidence of intent, and concluded, with this generous definition, that bad faith is present here as elsewhere. So this is not just Mr. Reyes's problem. It's a serious problem, endemic to my small sample of cases. I see there are no further questions. I'll be happy to sit down now.
Judge Mormon, do you have it? Okay, thank you very much. The case is submitted. We'll greet counsel.
All rise.